This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy. In late December 1914, a curious thing happened on the Western Front in Europe. World War I had broken out just a few months earlier, but in that short time, tens of thousands of soldiers had been killed. And then, on December 24th, the shooting suddenly stopped. Here's how one British soldier described it in a letter to his family.
On Christmas Eve, the Germans, entrenched opposite us, began calling out to us. Cigarettes, pudding, and a happy Christmas. So two of our fellows climbed over the parapet of the trench and went towards the German trenches. Halfway, they were met by four Germans, who said they would not shoot on Christmas Day if we did not. They gave our fellows cigars and a bottle of wine, and were given a cake and cigarettes. When they came back, I went out with some more of our fellows, and we were met by about 30 Germans, who seemed to be very nice fellows. All through the night, we sang carols to them, and they sang to us.
In the larger scheme, of course, that was a momentary blip. The fighting resumed after Christmas and would claim some 15 million lives before ending for good 4 years later. We mention the story here only because it seemed like an especially poignant illustration of the outsized role that Christmas plays on the modern calendar. Sure, it happened in Europe, beyond the purview of the History Guy's standard repertoire, but there's no denying that Christmas has been the big deal of holidays on this side of the Atlantic, too.
And so today on our show, we're going to explore the history of Christmas in America. Was it always such an important holiday? How did Christmas traditions develop and evolve? Do the holiday's Christian connotations pose a challenge to the ideals of the founders that America should be a pluralistic society with no official religion? And what about the other wintertime holidays like Hanukkah and Kwanzaa? Would as many Americans be celebrating them if it weren't for Christmas?
We'll begin at the end of the story. Christmas in the 21st century.
Back in the book segment tonight, we continue our reporting on which American stores are using Christmas in advertising this Christmas season, and which are not.
We've mentioned war and we've mentioned Christmas, but in case you haven't heard, there's a war being waged on Christmas. At least that's what certain cable news personalities have been saying. Until last year, John Gibson was one of those personalities. He hosted The Big Story on the Fox News Channel. And back in 2005, he published a book called The War on Christmas, How the Liberal Plot to Ban the Sacred Christian Holiday is Worse Than You Thought. It argued that every year, local governments and school boards issue bans on everything from Santa Claus to calling a Christmas tree a Christmas tree, and that this flies in the face of Supreme Court rulings that holiday displays on government property are constitutional, so long as they don't give special status to any one religion. I recently reached John Gibson on the phone in Texas, where he now hosts a radio show for Fox News.
I think the rules are pretty clear. And yet, when I went out and did a little bit of investigation about what was going on around the country, what I found was that people in these local governments were just making things up. They were just sort of saying, well, I think the rule ought to be X and so they would do it, without any consideration to what the courts had said.
Okay, and these warriors, what is their objective? What's the promised land for these folks? What are they fighting for?
They're trying not to get sued. They're trying not to cause any controversy. And so they start making up rules about what a religious symbol is and what can be displayed. Let's say you work in the county administration office and you want to put a little Santa Claus on your desk or something, you might find a rule coming down, no Santa Clauses, it's a religious symbol. Well, it's not.
It just strikes me that what you just described is bureaucrats behaving like bureaucrats,
correct,
not warriors declaring war on Christmas.
Well, there's a lot of both. I mean, there are people who have decided we're going to change what Christmas is.
Yeah.
We're going to make it a much more ecumenical, all-encompassing thing that just isn't Christian. You could go to the ACLU website, and you could see that the ACLU's position is that Christians can celebrate Christmas in their churches and in their homes. And from that, one might deduce that the ACLU is chasing this holiday out of the public, not just the public square, but out of public view.
That's John Gibson, host of The John Gibson Show on Fox News Radio. Following our conversation, we did as he suggested, and we went to the ACLU's website. There we found a statement that read in part as follows. Religious expression is a valued part of the First Amendment rights guaranteed all citizens, but government should never be in the business of endorsing things like religious displays. Religion is best served when the government plays no role in promoting any particular holiday or any individual religious tradition. That job is best suited for individuals, families, and religious communities. So, Peter, Ed, I mean, whether or not you accept the notion that there is a war on Christmas, there certainly does seem to be a conflict here about how public Christmas should be.
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about how does this fit into the flow of time? And from a historical point of view, there's truth to both of these point of views. You know, for many centuries, Christmas was very much a public, on the streets, in your face kind of thing. But, Peter, did that public celebration really have much to do with Christ at all?
Well, not a word in the Bible says when Jesus was born. It wasn't, in fact, until the 4th century after his death that church officials finally decided that he was born on December 25th, and that's when Christians should celebrate. But why that day? Well, that date was already a date that people were celebrating. Hmm. It's the winter solstice. It's Saturnalia. It's when slaves and masters reverse positions. It's a prominent part of pre-Christian cultures all over Europe. The Roman Catholic Church was essentially branding a much older holiday, trying to co-opt all
appropriating.
That. Appropriating. Yeah. To co-opt all that celebratory energy and direct it toward its own purposes. But here's the thing. This project of the church didn't really work. There is an historian named Steve Nissenbaum who wrote about all of this in a book called The Battle for Christmas. When I spoke to him recently, he explained that Europeans continued to celebrate Christmas more or less the way they had celebrated that much older wintertime festival, even after they arrived in America.
It happened that Christmas took place during a season when there was, at least for males in an agricultural society, not a lot of work to be done. And it was also a season when there was plenty of fresh food and fresh alcoholic drink. So it's a season of excess. It's a season of letting go. It's a season of overdoing.
That sounds a little bit like New Year's Eve, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think that what's happened is that New Year's Eve essentially has become the one place where ritual public misbehavior remains sanctioned. Yeah. But if you can go back before 1800, it was the entire season. But this misbehavior didn't just take random forms. It was highly ritualized. And the ritual really took the form of what is often called social inversion. That is to say, for this one ritual time of year, the high and the low turn the tables on each other. On this one occasion, and it's an occasion, remember, that's going to be fueled by alcohol, these people in the lower orders feel that they can act as if they're the bosses, and they can go around town entitled to bang on the doors of their betters, perhaps the people that they work for themselves, and demand more alcohol, the best food that the lord of the manor has to offer, even sometimes money. You can think of it as being a sort of like Halloween,
right.
Like a bad Halloween, because if these beggars didn't get the drink or the food or whatever gift they demanded, they were liable to threaten or even to perform damage.
Steve, the more you talk about this, the more un-American it sounds to me. After all, as my man Jefferson would have said, all men are created equal. You can't have that kind of celebration or inversion in a world of equals, can you?
Yeah, but one of the interesting things about this social inversion form of Christmas is that it was not a demand for equality. It was, in fact, a reinforcement of the social order because the poor were not trying to eliminate distinctions of status. They were maintaining those distinctions of status, but they were inverting them.
That's historian Steven Nissenbaum, author of the 1997 book, The Battle for Christmas. In a few minutes, we'll hear more from him about how Christmas turned from bad Halloween into the celebration of comfort and joy we celebrate today.
Oh, maid, with your glove and your lace, pray come unto this door and show us your fine face.
You know, that's a really interesting discussion, Peter, and it reminds me of a question we got on the website from Rhonda Newton, and here's what she wrote. I have to wonder if my family's tradition of a low-key Christmas, focusing on church and family with gifts but not as the focus, goes back to our New England Puritan roots, leavened with some Quakers and Scots-Irish Presbyterians. So, Peter, my question is this. Did everything Steve was talking about come to an end with the Puritans, or did it take these other religions to kind of take some of the air out of Christmas?
Well, Ed, that's a great question. The Puritans' approach to Christmas was not low-key. It was no-key. In fact, they actually banned it, made it illegal.
They really were grouches, weren't they, Peter?
Yeah, absolutely. The Puritans were hypersensitive to the idea of sacralizing days because they thought of the whole world as God's work. Everything is sacred. So the distinctions between holidays and everydays were strictly taboo. In fact, one of the whole reasons that the Puritans came to New England was to get away from the saints' days that proliferated in the English calendar, and that is every day of the year seemed to be a saint's day, so that they didn't work at all. Remember, Puritans, work ethic.
So they wanted to sacralize everything
desacralizing
just a few days.
That's right.
Okay, other than tell me, Rhonda talks about church and family as 20th century guy. We think in those terms.
Right.
How did church and family get back into that Christmas picture?
Well, I think by the 19th century, that Puritan spirit of hostility to Catholicism is what it comes down to, and that all the ceremonies associated with it had given way to a more generous and Catholic, with a small c, spirit and openness. At the same time, there was a new religiosity that had emerged in the Second Great Awakening in America in the early 19th century, where lots of people were turning to evangelical Christianity, and they were taking Christianity seriously in a way that the mass of colonial Americans had never done. So you have both a more secular spirit and a more religious spirit converging and then creating a new calendar of semi-sacred holidays.
And you know what's so ironic is that that work ethic, which was pitted against singling out Christmas, has come back as one of the major reasons to do Christmas.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, we literally adjust our unemployment statistics these days to adjust for all the employment around hiring for the Christmas season.
Wow. History just kind of is interesting, isn't it? The way it just folds back on itself.
We keep wondering why we keep doing it, Ed, but there you go.
Well, we've got to take a break. When we come back, I promise to find a way to work Hanukkah into this show.
We'll be back in a minute. This is Backstory, the show that turns to history to explain the world around us today. I'm Peter Onuff, and I represent 18th century America.
I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century U.S. of A.
And I'm Brian Bellow, representing the 20th century. We're talking today about the history of the so-called holiday season. When we left off, our 18th century guide, Peter, was explaining that the Puritans not only didn't celebrate Christmas, but actually made the holiday illegal, which wasn't too surprising, considering that for centuries, it had basically consisted of a multi-day bonanza of booze-fueled partying. But despite the Puritans' best attempts, people continued to celebrate Christmas the old-fashioned way well into the 19th century.
And then, in the 1820s, something began to change. Newspapers started running Christmas-themed ads for local merchants. Now, this was a new development. Buying gifts for people, after all, wasn't a part of the old Christmas. And a lot of those ads featured a certain character who was also a new addition to the holiday, St. Nicholas, a.k.a. Santa Claus, first popularized in American newspapers in the form of a poem.
'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
A Visit from St. Nicholas was written in 1823 by Clement Clark Moore, a theology professor and a member of New York's very upper crust. Now, he owned a huge estate on New York's west side. He was just the kind of guy likely to be visited by Christmas beggars demanding the master's best food and drink.
When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter.
What was the matter, of course, was that there was a little old fat man on the lawn, just the kind of guy who would have joined up with those traditional holiday beggars. Here's historian Stephen Nissenbaum again.
He's dressed in sooty fur. He's carrying what amounts to a beggar's pack on his back. He looks like a plebeian. But this particular figure of Santa Claus doesn't come to make demands. He comes to give gifts to the narrator's kids.
Now, the character of Saint Nick wasn't entirely new to American audiences. He had first appeared in A Mock History of Old New York, written by Moore's good friend Washington Irving. But that Saint Nick was portrayed as he had appeared back in Holland, as a patrician bishop. It was Clement Clark Moore's defrocking of Santa that signaled the beginning of Christmas as we know it. Let's return now to my conversation with Steve Nissenbaum, author of The Battle for Christmas.
The simplest, really oversimplest way to put the deeper change that caused the new Christmas to come about in the 1820s was really rapid urbanization and the early stages of capitalism.
Right.
And what those two things coming together did was it took the traditional kind of begging rituals, mm-hmm, the traditional trick-or-treat rituals, which had gone on for centuries, and it sort of intensified the tension that was involved in them, because now, since we're dealing with densely populated cities, the poor who go around in bands are no longer poor people who are known personally to the rich people whose houses they bang the doors on. Now they're an anonymous, to use a fancy word, proto-proletariat.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in the process of being transformed from traditional apprentices and clerks into what's within a generation going to become an urban proletariat.
To some extent, you're talking about changing conceptions of the social order from a notion of status and familiar position in the community to a more anonymous, something resembling what we might call class, the dangerous classes. The streets are dangerous places. And
the streets are becoming dangerous places.
But meanwhile, the other thing that's happening in the house is that children are, in effect, stepping up and demanding gifts. Where did kids get off becoming kids in the way they are today?
Well, here's one way to talk about that. Those bands of roving beggars at Christmas time would have consisted of the poor, but also would have consisted rather promiscuously of young people, even sometimes young people from wealthy households. That essentially is going to risk subverting the social order in a rather profound way.
Yeah.
And so white people in New York, some very wealthy, very conservative people in New York, started doing in the 18-teens and 1820s was, in fact, to come up with a new kind of holiday that barricaded the doors, if you like, against beggars from the outside, and that then sanctioned giving gifts to your own children within the family. So what you're simultaneously beginning to get is the fortress household, the fortress family, and the whole new idea of children as people who should be deferred to. Previously, I mean, children, in a sense, had been servants within their own household.
Yeah. Dependents in a household.
Dependents in the household. But on Christmas Day, given this very old tradition of inverting the social order, you know, and now limiting that inversion to the internal workings of the family itself, I think for many families, Christmas is the first moment when you begin to sort of look at your children in a new way.
I love
and
that.
Look at them as objects of affection and objects of sentiment. And I think that the new Christmas that gets devised in the 1820s is really part of that process by which the family that we know of today, the modern family, which we think of sometimes as the traditional family, itself is being invented.
Well, Steve, I want to press you on gift giving because it's so central to our modern understanding of Christmas.
Yes.
And it seems to me gifts carry a heavy burden. They're supposed to be deeply personal expressions of the love that cements family relations.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time,
They're commodities.
To put it simply, they are commodities. Yeah. So how have Americans, particularly in this kind of founding era of modern Christmas, how do they resolve the tension between commodity exchange? After all, that's the nasty business of the marketplace that's supposed to be what we're escaping when we turn toward the home, and we're the heartless world outside. We come into the warm, sentimental bosom of our family. So how do Americans deal with the commodity status of gifts?
Yeah, it's in a phrase, Santa Claus. From the very beginning, that part of it got disguised, I mean, to use the bluntest word, by saying that Santa Claus brought these gifts. Also by the fact that they're wrapped, they're gift wrapped, they're somehow special. And so the combination of gift wrapping and Santa Claus essentially takes them out of the marketplace. They magically appear. And in fact, by 1840, you're in a very common way beginning to get Santa Claus used by merchants to advertise his wares. You get ads in the newspapers saying, come to Santa Claus's favorite haunt and buy these goods. And that's, of course, defeating the whole purpose. Right. And one of the really fascinating things that I found is that beginning in the 1830s, a group of wealthy Bostonians, for the most part, decided that they needed a new ritual that would decommercialize Christmas in a way that Santa had failed to do. And that new ritual was the Christmas tree. They thought mistakenly that the Christmas tree was an old German ritual in which children actually gave gifts to their parents.
Wow. Had that ever actually happened, Steve?
It apparently happened in one family in one town in northern Germany called Ratzeburg. And it so happened that that family was being visited in the 1790s by the future poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote about it in an essay that he published around 1810. And what happened is that the press started picking this up in the 1830s after the Coleridge essay got reprinted. And the fact that it was limited to his observation of a single household got lost.
And who says individuals don't matter in history, huh?
Individuals matter in history. So, well, of course, Coleridge, you know, wanted to see something like that, and Americans were ready for something like that. So they decided that the Christmas tree was this pure, completely uncommercial ritual that was commonplace in Germany, which it was not.
So in a way, folk rituals were juxtaposed to commercial practices when, in fact, they were part and parcel of the same thing.
They were. I mean, I think that you can almost see the history of Christmas as an ongoing series of efforts to decommercialize it, and every effort to decommercialize it and purify it then becomes appropriated or co-opted.
Yeah.
You know, it's really almost inevitable.
Well, Steve, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
You're very welcome, and thank you, Peter, so much for having me on this show.
Stephen Nissenbaum is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Massachusetts. He's the author of The Battle for Christmas, published in 1997. You can find an extended version of our interview in our website, along with a downloadable MP3 of a fascinating conversation Steve and I had about Christmas in the Slave South. It's all at backstoryradio.org.
All right. I'm impressed. You've exploded a lot of myths that I actually subscribe to. But I want to get personal now.
Mm-hmm.
When exactly did you stop believing in Santa Claus?
I'm sure it was at school and some smarter kid just told me, and it was like so many other things I discovered about life. Oh, really? I had no idea.
Well, Ed, you got to be careful what you listen to, because I listened to all my Jewish friends, and they told me over and over again the story of Hanukkah. And it all turned on this great military victory by the Maccabees. We beat back the Assyrians. We reclaimed the temple. And then the central miracle, we found a drop of oil, and we lit the candles with that, knowing that the candles would soon burn out. But in fact, they lasted for 8 days and 8 nights. Mm-hmm. And to this very day, we celebrate that by lighting the candles, that victory and that miracle that God provided to us.
Boy, that's a powerful story.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you how it ends. It ends in me discovering that that's all a myth. Oh. Those candles came crashing down around my head. And you know how the news was broken to me? In a YouTube video 3 days ago.
Wow. How 20th century? Man.
21st century. Yeah, I'm angling for that century. And the video was made by Laura Baum, a Reform rabbi in Cincinnati, who founded an online congregation called ourjewishcommunity.org. We found the rabbi's number and gave her a call. I want to just jump right in here, Rabbi.
Okay.
I have bought hundreds, maybe even thousands, of Hanukkah candles at full retail price. And now I learn that maybe this whole drop of oil lasting 8 days thing is like a complete fabrication. Yeah, you got to help me out here. I mean, and is there some place I can get my money back?
Yeah, essentially the original versions of the Hanukkah story, which are recorded in the Book of Maccabees, don't mention oil and don't mention God at all. Hanukkah is a story about Jewish national power, a fractured community, and essentially a military struggle. And it was during a time of crisis in the period when the rabbis feared that the Jews would rebel against Rome that they later decided to de-emphasize the Jewish might and turn the story into one about a miracle of oil lasting for 8 days.
I see. So for political reasons, basically, it was better to spin the story, if you will, as a more pacifist, less militaristic story.
Exactly. If we could just step back and rely on a miracle, then we'd all be fine with sort of the rabbinic period's view of it. But it was for a very specific point. The temple had been destroyed. There were two failed rebellions. The rabbis were now encouraging the Jews to essentially stop fighting and to turn inward. They didn't want the Jews to rebel against Rome.
Well, I was wondering if you could take us through some of the other twists and turns of the Hanukkah story, if there are any more twists and turns.
Sure. I think another one that comes to mind is in the late 19th century in the United States when the Civil War was over, anti-Semitism was on the rise, and Jewish revivalists at that point placed the emphasis of the Hanukkah story back on Jewish national strength and survival again and de-emphasized the oil. They said, we need to somehow capitalize on the American experience and make that a Jewish experience and meld those two together. And so they made it a story again about Jewish national strength, which added some energy, of course, to help Hanukkah compete with the Christmas that was so popular in American culture.
And could you be a little more specific about how that made it more American?
I think that it became more American at that point because it was really a story about resistance and going for what you wanted, becoming a nation, renewing a nation.
I see. So hearkening it back almost to the American Revolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got it. Well, do you have kids of your own?
No.
Do you have nieces and nephews?
Yeah.
I want to know what you tell them the story of Hanukkah is.
I think that it's really important when we're teaching children about religion to never tell them anything that we would have to unteach them later. So I run the religious school here, and we don't share the oil story as a real story and then 10 years later say to the kids, oh, by the way, that wasn't historically accurate. But I think with children, it's fine to teach the story of the oil and to say that some of the traditions we have, like lighting candles and eating potato pancakes and greasy jelly donuts, that those all connect to the myth of the oil. But we're really careful to call it a myth and to explain that that's why those traditions exist. And then to teach that there are other historical reasons for the holiday. And I think it's a great learning opportunity to say, look at how this holiday changed and what's our role going to be in the continuing evolution of the Jewish experience? How are we going to add our own spin on Hanukkah?
And what would you say the essence of the real, not the mythical, but the real Jewish experience is in regard to Hanukkah?
I think that Hanukkah is not a story that has only one message. I think it's become a wonderful way for families and friends to celebrate. I think it's a way for Jews to feel part of the American experience while their peers are, in many cases, celebrating Christmas. But I think it's more than that. I think that the messages from the first versions of the Hanukkah story, which are recorded in Second Maccabees, are really stories about standing up for what you believe in, doing the right thing, building a people, trying to find a common voice in a community, and also respecting individual voices. So I think that those are incredibly important messages of Hanukkah that we can continue to find value in.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rabbi Laura Baum is based at the Beth Adam Temple in Cincinnati, Ohio. She's also the founding rabbi of ourjewishcommunity.org, an online congregation. We'll link to her three-minute YouTube explication of the Hanukkah story at backstoryradio.org.
No, I thought that was a very generous and helpful understanding of all that. Things aren't debunking, outrage,
right.
You know, just sort of thinking there's a reason these things exist, and that's good, and we can still continue sharing them with our children and our families. It doesn't mean that you have to choose one over another. It strikes me as a very capacious way of understanding, you know?
You know, and frankly, it makes me feel a lot better about a holiday we dropped from our own family's celebration, Kwanzaa. For a period there, we celebrated Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa. And, you know, the people I hang out with, PhDs in history, wise guys, this African historian said, you know, Kwanzaa's just totally invented. And it was hard to celebrate it after that. If I had only met you guys
earlier, be okay with it. Yeah.
I would have known from the start that all three holidays were very much invented and simply evolved in relationship to other religious holidays, and not to mention the kind of culture that they were embedded in.
We've been focusing on invention and the way holidays are created at specific moments in time, that things come together, cultural forces, and lead to this celebration of a holiday. But we should also remember, when we're thinking about invention, that these holidays, these celebrations work for people. They do something.
Yeah, we don't make holidays up for no reason. And we act as if they own us, when in fact they are us.
It's time for another short break. When we get back, we'll go to the phones and offer a couple of lucky listeners our favorite gift, the gift of gab.
Hanukkah linda está aquí, ocho candelas para mí.
We'll be back in a minute.